From Hollywood, it's time now for... Johnny Dollar. Tonight, and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Gigi Little, author of the debut novel Who Killed One the Gun from Forest Avenue Press. I first interviewed Gigi 9 years ago for an anthology she edited, City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales. Since then, I've talked with Gigi for The Untold Gaze, a book she created and edited with her husband, the artist Stephen O'Donnell, and the children's picture book, A Tree of My Own, for which she served as art director and cover designer. Her writing has appeared in journals and anthologies, including Portland Noir, Spent, and Dispatches from Menaris, and her work as a much-in-demand cover designer and staff designer for Forest Avenue Press has graced many a book. She's also one of the organizers of the annual Portland Writers Picnic. Who Killed One the Gun is Gigi's first book of her own. In the words of Lydia Yuknovich, Gigi Little just gave noir mouth to mouth. Who Killed One the Gun resuscitates what was last best about old-school radio noir with a spectacular post-genre kick, a genre and gender-bending brilliant beat of a book. Please join us for our conversation with Gigi Little, which is already in progress. Well, Gigi, we've talked for the radio many times, but I never got too far into your own story. So let's go back a few years. Where did you grow up? I guess that's going back quite a few years.
Yeah.
And what was your family like?
Oh, gosh. I grew up in mostly Southern California, except that I born in D.C. and actually lived in Australia for 3 years when I was a very small child, too small to really remember. But yeah, California from when I was like 6 onward and have a wonderful family. When I was first studying writing in Dangerous Writing with Tom Spanbauer, you write a lot about your own story, and there was a lot of like dysfunctional family stuff. And in
I encounter that all the time in
right?
author interviews. Yeah.
And I was writing a book for my own story, and the family was great, and everybody's like, "That's not realistic," you know. Yeah, it's a great. I have a great family, fam.
Now you mentioned as a kid, this was at your Powell's launch. You had your own world made of toys, and you called it Little Town, which has a double meaning. So pretty clever for a kid.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of that when I was a kid. Yeah.
So you had your own kind of simulated city there.
Yeah,
like SimCity, the video game pre-video games.
Pre-Sim. Yeah, I, my brother and sister, my cousin, my friends, we all had a town. And I was the one who started it, and so I got to have the clever name based on my last name. But it was my cousin followed suit with Tiny Town. That's not her last name, though.
No, but you could give her that nickname.
Yeah, yes, I should have.
Now, I've known for a while that you ran away with the circus, mm-hmm. I think as a teenager. But I don't know much more than that, so this is a great opportunity to satisfy my excessive curiosity. Was it Toby Tyler or Something Wicked This Way Comes?
Probably more Toby Tyler than Something Wicked, for sure. I married into it. My ex was a clown and a ringmaster, and I became a clown, and I was in the business for 15 years.
Did you train as a clown then?
I did not.
Oh.
He did not either, actually. His dad
was
a clown,
natural.
Too.
Oh,
he was a natural.
So he had it in the genes.
Yes, and I was not a natural. I was not good. I wanted to be. It was very exciting and very, very colorful and very cool at first. But I was not. I don't think I was very funny, at least in the ring.
Do you remember any of the bits? Did you do the clown car thing, or you all get
never
into
did
the
clown car? Huh. Never did the clown car. There was a dentist routine where I was a patient, and I even played Bill Clinton one time. There was this thing where I was Bill Clinton being chased by giant French fries around the big circus. Anyway.
That sounds like it'd be funny. I think you got some laughs there, even though you probably didn't think you were as funny as the audience did.
That was easy because it was a complete sight gag. But for other things, when you had to interact and particularly when you had to speak, I think there was a little disconnect too, because I sort of dressed like a little man. I had a little bowler hat, a little bow tie and stuff. And I had this girl's voice, you know, and I think that actually made me feel like I didn't fit. But I think just generally, I just did not have the talent for it.
Yeah. Well, you have so many other talents, so.
I had to get away from circus to be funny, I think, you know.
Now, how'd you go from the circus to Portland? And here starting to get serious about your writing.
Well, I had always wanted to be a writer. And when I divorced the clown, I moved back to California for a while and then moved up here. My aunt and cousin both lived up here. And my husband now, he lived up here. I met him up here. And
Stephen O'Donnell.
O'Donnell,
great,
yes.
Great artist.
Fabulous artist, yes. And when I first came up to visit my aunt, I met local writer Steve Arndt, who, of course, is the Portland Writers Picnic guru.
We call him the connector.
Yes, the connector, yeah. I've spoken to him many times. I met him, and he told me, you have to meet my mentor, Tom Spanbauer. And he took me to Tom and introduced me to him, and then I got into Tom's writing group, Dangerous Writing, and I was in there for years and years. I was in there from, I think, 2005 until it disbanded in 2017-ish, something like that.
And I think Margaret Malone, who hosted your Powell's book launch, mm-hmm. was in the group at the time?
She wasn't there when I first joined, but she was definitely there during part of the time that I was.
Yeah, what I'm getting at is a pretty talented group.
Very talented
group. Margaret and definitely after.
Yes.
Did it take a while to feel like you fit in but could hold your own?
Yeah, yes, it did. I mean, this might sort of go hand in hand with the comments I keep making about clowning. I didn't have a lot of self-confidence in general, you know, so I may have been a better clown than I thought. I may have been a better writer than I thought, you know.
I'll bet you were.
Yeah. But in those days, I felt very fish out of water for a long time. But I shouldn't say for a long time. I felt very fish out of water when I joined, but it didn't take long for you to feel like it was a family.
You were welcomed by the other writers in the group, and you're still in touch with a lot of them.
Oh, very much. Yes. Yeah. I'm in a writing group now called The Gong Show. And we don't gong each other and make each other leave the stage. But we're all former Dangerous Writers. We are Dangerous Writers. We're all former from the group.
Now, what you said, you felt a little self-conscious joining up, but you said, and you were raw as a writer. You know, mm-hmm. you learned quite a bit in Dangerous Writers.
Oh, yeah.
But you said you brought a, quote, rampant imagination to the group, which is a great place to start, especially since I think craft can be taught, but imagination seems almost something you're born with, almost inherent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think everybody has something they bring to the table when they first start anything, you know, but when they first start writing and learning, and that was what I did have, you know. I feel like I could come up with all sorts of ideas, but how to adequately put them on the page. That's what Tom taught me.
And that's the craft.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So now you're a member of the Gong Show. You also mentioned in the book's acknowledgments the Henry Group.
Yes.
You still go to that one too? Or?
We don't meet anymore, but that was another group that I was in that included Margaret Malone, actually. And when I was writing Who Killed One the Gun, I brought that to both writing groups at the same time.
Did you get very different takes on the manuscript, the early manuscript?
I don't think so. I think I I think that the sort of reception and feedback that I got was very similar in both sides. One group was weekly, one group was biweekly, so the timing was very different between the two. So I wasn't reading the same thing at the same time, which is interesting. But yeah, I think that the feedback and the help I got was very similar between the two.
So let's go to Who Killed Won the Gun. You mentioned, I think again, at Powell's, that you first conceived of the book in 2002.
Yeah.
While you were still traveling with the circus.
Yeah.
And you remember that exact moment?
Well, the reason I know is that I also am a chronic journaler. And I was looking back through my journals trying to find out the origin story. I had a questionnaire to fill out for my publisher, Forest Avenue Press, when I first signed with them. And one of the questions was, you know, what is the history of the book? You know, where does it come from? And so I just popped over into my diaries and found out. And yeah, I was so happy that I had written down the exact date and
you remember
and
the moment too, right? Yeah. So you were driving, your husband at the time was driving, you were the passenger in
mm-hmm.
the car.
Yeah.
And what just came to you?
Well, I was really interested in the book Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow. And I loved the fact that his characters, he had some characters that had real names, like Harry Houdini, like he had real people in there, but he also had names like father, mother, mother's younger brother. Those were the characters' names. That's all you ever, you know, heard.
Generic,
and I thought, generic, but it seems so, it's just so clever to me. And so I thought, I'd like to do something similar, but take it one step further. What about names that are numbers? What about names that are numbers with corresponding rhymes? You know, so that the idea sprouted the first name, which was won the gun. You know, I thought I went to the first number. I got a rhyme just popped into my head, and I thought,
gun came right away.
Yeah, won the gun. You know, won the.
Because he used to be won the fun. Huh?
That was in his early 8 days. Yes, he was. Yeah. Yeah, but his original name, yeah, the first name that popped into my head, he just seemed like he must be a gumshoe, you know.
Right, or a gangster.
Or a gangster. I mean, you know, that's the thing that I've thought about recently. I've always thought it was just kind of expected that he would be a gumshoe, but that's not true. Those are the interests that are in me. You know, somebody else might make him a Western, you know, a cowboy.
Oh, exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things that you could be with that name. So it's actually kind of like a bit of a Rorschach test, you know? If I said two, the true blue, if I said three, the goatee, who would they create in your head, you know? So, but for me, and I was, you know, I've always been very interested in, you know, old time and noir and detective stories. And so anyway, he became a detective and... So, yeah, I was on the road. I was frantically writing down, okay, one, the gun. Okay, two, the true blue. Who is she? Three, the goatee. Who is he? And the story kind of built itself around the little seed, you know. And that was the only thing. That was the story. That was the thing that I wrote down at the time. I wrote a whole novel filled with those names that was...
Oh, I was going to ask about that. So you started, or at least the initial idea of Who Killed Won the Gun, over 20 years ago. But since that time, I read that you had completed two novels, though unpublished so far.
Yeah,
I mean, that was one of them.
No, that was I don't know how many novels I've completed that are unpublished. You know, my original story that had Won the Gun in it was a novel that I wrote that was different. I was very young. It was not a very good novel. I don't even remember any of it. It's lost to time. You know. And I put it away. And then once I moved to California, once I moved from California to Portland and started studying with Tom Spanbauer, I wrote two novels in that class that were different ones. And then came back to Won the Gun.
And you still have those?
I have them, you know, yes, they're in my computers and various folders and various.
I think every writer I've talked to has a similar file.
Yes, I have many. I mean, and you know, those were books that I wrote to learn to write. And once I had the skill, then this is what came out of it, I think.
Kind of training wheels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when you did come back to Who Killed Won the Gun, how did it evolve from the original idea? Or was it just really you already had the original idea and the story just kind of came from that?
Well, yes and no. Like the original story had One the Gun as a detective and Two the True Blue as his assistant. But, and that was, it was sort of a, like an anthology movie, you know, when you watch a movie where there's like four different stories.
Oh, sure.
It was like that in book form. And so there was a detective story and then there was, you know, a couple different other kinds of stories. And I don't think the detective story was at all the same as this. It was just the, I think the only remnants are the names and the fact that there is a detective story in there.
So it evolved quite a bit.
It evolved a lot. And in the meantime, I got really into, I got much more into film noir. I think back in the day, I just had a sense in my head of sort of the cartoon version of noir, the sort of caricature that you get if you watch parodies or
things
like that.
Oh, yes.
You know?
It's easy to parody.
It's very, and it's fun to parody. You know?
Exactly.
It's also easy to parody badly, I'll say.
You know. There's a lot of that out there.
Yeah.
Now, you started with the title character, One the Gun, and mm-hmm. Two to True Blue, also his mm-hmm. his trusty assistant.
Yeah.
He's very much modeled after detectives and investigators in old-time radio.
Yes.
And as you mentioned, noir movies and mm-hmm. stories, you know, the Pulp Fiction, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah, yeah.
What were the shows you were listening to? And was Gunn modeled after a specific character or maybe a composite of those old-time detectives?
Mm. That's a good question. It was...
Well, I know you and I share a love for the old show, yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yes.
Which was kind of latter-day golden age, you know, mm-hmm. 50s.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely one of my favorites. And I think that One the Gun as a character probably just sort of emerged from all the different, because I've listened to many, many different old-time radio detective shows. So I think he just sort of came as a conglomerate of that. But I did make the case an insurance case so that it could be a reference to Johnny Dollar.
Yeah, Johnny Dollar is an insurance investigator.
Right.
I think, what did they call with the action-packed expense account?
Yeah.
He's obsessed with the expense account.
Yeah, yeah, super fun. It's such a fun, and it's the longest standing detective show that, And it was actually one of the last two. They say that the closing of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, and I think maybe Suspense, which is a sci-fi show.
It's like, also pretty much a long-running show.
Very long-running show. Oh. And when those two, like the day that those two on the same day had their last episodes, that was the end of Golden Age Radio, they call it, yeah.
And I think there were four or five Johnny Dollars. Interesting, when I looked up the show, I'd been listening for a while, but I never really read the background.
Yeah.
One of the first actors to audition for the Johnny Dollar role was Dick Powell.
Yeah.
But he didn't get the part.
Right.
I don't know why. And we'll talk a little bit about him, too, as we go on.
Yeah.
We should mention also that you have your own fictional old-time radio shows in the book. One is called Who Is the Villain? And it's an anthology with the exclamation mark, so I'm not sure. It's an anthology of hard-boiled detective stories. And then The Rim of Beyond, a science fiction anthology series.
Yeah.
In fact, we learned there's an episode of The Rim of Beyond that is a similar theme of a man stuck in a time loop. So what were some of your favorite sci-fi old-time radio shows? Suspense really wasn't sci-fi, but there were others.
They had, yeah, Suspense had sort of the range in it, including sci-fi. I liked X-1.
Yes.
And it's, I can't remember which one came first. There's X-1 and then there's Dimension X.
Dimension X.
Yeah.
You're two at the top, I think.
I love them so much. Yeah, they're so great. They're so great.
And,
those are probably my favorites.
And I'm thinking, what about noir books and movies? Any favorites and influences? You mentioned one, mm-hmm. The movie Murder, My Sweet.
Yes. Yeah, that was a big influence on the book because the reason I wanted to write the book through the lens of old-time radio is that I love the language. And a lot of that language is very Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, Murder, My Sweet, for those who don't know, is based on the Raymond Chandler book, Farewell, My Lovely.
Yes.
I guess Hollywood didn't think that was catchy enough a title.
Oh, yeah. It's full of that same wonderful, crazy, campy language that's in old-time radio. So
starring?
Starring Dick Powell, yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. He's
not,
great.
Not the best Philip Marlowe, but an acceptable one, huh?
Yeah, I like him. I like him a lot as a Philip Marlowe. He's a little, you know, lighter, a little funnier, but his sort of sardonic kind of sense of humor, I think he's good.
And he was that kind of old Hollywood guy who did everything, like a Jimmy Cagney. He could sing and dance and he could act. He was a gangster. And Dick Powell, of course, was in 42nd Street.
Yes.
And a few other musicals in addition to being this hard-boiled Philip Marlowe detective in Murder, My Sweet.
Yeah.
So they had a lot of range then. I guess they
he
had
really
to.
Did.
They were making four or five movies a year, right, on contract for the studio.
And he was in a lot of old-time radio, Dick Powell. And he was in, I'm trying to remember which one is the one he was in where he was a gumshoe, but he also, in every episode, got to sing a little, you know, so they kind of combined.
I don't know that one.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
The singing detective.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a Steve Martin movie or something? I'm pretty sure. Now, to set up the story for listeners, Gigi, I wonder if you would read the prologue to the book for us?
Sure. At 12 midnight, on the 11th of the month, as the tower bells chime and the moon reflects 10,000 moons in the 10,000 windows of the city, chasing shadows across 9 dark storefronts along the square, some certain moonbeam banks an 8-point ricochet and snaps a 7-second beeline of the 6-story building on 5th Street, where it shoots through a 4-by-3-foot ground-level window of 2-layer glass, straight to the basement floor, where one wide circle of blood is spreading out around the body of one man, one the gun. He has 1 minute to live.
I wouldn't be offended if readers go out now and buy a copy of the book because they want to find out. No, that's a great teaser. Wow.
Thanks. Yeah.
Now, once you had won the gun and the other numbered characters, so you mentioned 2, the true blue, 3, the goatee.
Yep.
The murder victim is 5, the no longer alive.
Yes.
There's a preacher, 7, the heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And his twin is 11, the leaven.
It's 7, the heaven, and 11, the
the 11.
That's hard to say on the radio, isn't it?
You're right, because he's 11 to 11 because he's a baker.
Yeah, yes.
and there's a lot of fun wordplay like that using the numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, it was so much fun. I mean, it was, I got to just play all the time trying to figure out what names can I make and, you know, what numbers can I use, you know.
Now, once you had those names, you know, a reader's going to pick that up and feel maybe that's a little too gimmicky. But it doesn't seem to me, you know, reading it, that that's the case. How did you do that? it's almost a magic trick. You turn them into what we consider real characters, real people on the page.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I will start by saying I love a good gimmick. I love gimmicky books. You know, I think about Slaughterhouse-Five, right? I mean, that book is all about a gimmick, but it's telling a very deep story. It's very funny, and it's telling a very important story.
A somewhat related gimmick to the time loop here, where Billy Pilgrim is stuck in time, as it's repeated throughout the book.
Yeah, I love that book. So I got so excited about that, I forgot what the question was.
Oh, how did you work that magic?
Oh, I don't know, because I feel like I crammed as many gimmicks as I could into one book, right? Time loop, old time noir, the numbers for names. It also takes place, the whole thing takes place in one city square. Like, nobody ever leaves the square. That's another gimmick that I put in there just because I love it. And actually, that gimmick is related to another film noir that's a favorite of mine called The Setup, which is not about a gumshoe at all. It's about boxing, but it takes place all in one square. And yeah, there's loads of, again, rampant imagination, I guess, in there. And yeah, so I don't know how I juggled it all, but
it walks a really fine line very successfully between these kind of fun gimmicks, as you refer to it, and just kind of the reader accepting these people as people. with thoughts, feelings, emotions.
Yeah, that's good to hear. You know, that was important to me to have them be human, even with their strange circumstances.
Now, you also follow the tropes of those 40s detectives on the radio, the big screen and print. In fact, at one point, you have a character tell one, "You listen to too many radio shows, Seamus." But you're also trying to make these characters real to us rather than familiar types. So in addition to the names, there's the tropes and another balancing act.
Yeah.
So they don't become just a noir stereotype.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard because I really wanted, like there's a femme fatale kind of character in there, Six the Kicks.
Six the Kicks, yes.
Yeah, she's the widow of Five the No Longer Alive, and she's just, you know, she's always out to get her kicks. And it's, so I wanted her to be as much of a of that type of trope as I could, but I also needed to make her real, and yeah, it was, I don't know that I really can say how I did it. I'm glad that they turned out to be real people. And of course,
I think giving them a life, a backstory, the relationships with other characters in the book, it makes them come alive on the page.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the novel takes place over 12 days with a lot of the same dialogue and events each day, except for a few differences that appear more as the days go on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because after one, the gun is shot, which happens on the very first page. Actually, on the title, we kind of know that. He wakes up stuck in this time loop we've been talking about.
Yeah.
One calls it a place where today is yesterday and yesterday is today.
Yeah.
And a little more is revealed each day. How did you decide and track what was repeated and what was a little different from day to day? I mean, that's a lot to keep track of what you're going to repeat in terms of dialogue, too.
Yeah.
And him meeting with certain characters and him kind of going off on a tangent because he can and he wants to solve this mystery. Who killed him?
Right. I mean, so his day runs from 12 noon to 12 midnight and loops back. And everybody else is doing what they always did, what they would have always done on that day, and he, because he's the one stuck in the time loop, he's the one who can change things. And it's a lot to juggle. At first, I just sort of started writing it and having a good time. And I don't know at what point I realized I need to make sure that I'm following things correctly. And then I outlined, you know, then I started outlining the book, and then I made a spreadsheet that was a calendar of each day, you know, which
and
with all the
happens.
Yeah.
And what's repeated and then where when the gun goes off.
And yeah, like he's always, you know, he always meets with for the door for his for their meeting at,
right,
you know,
they're,
I don't
they're
know
doing
what time,
interviews
1:30.
With the possible suspects.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there were a few times that I got caught in a hole, you know, and had to rethink my timing because I can't have him do this because this over here is happening, you know. But for the most part, so I made a spreadsheet. I like spreadsheets.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the repetition because at first, when you're trying to catch on as a reader, you're getting the same feeling when the gun gets, this deja vu.
Yeah.
At one point I said, didn't I read that like 20 pages ago?
Yes, you did.
And then you kind of figure it out as you go along.
Yeah. Every time, he, you know, every day at a certain time, he goes to the phone booth and he calls back to his office. And the wording is exactly the same. And so when we were in, and I don't know how many times that happens in the book, let's say it happens 6 times, the wording is exactly the same. And so when we did proofing and copy editing and you know, somebody said, we need to change this, I had to do, you know, I had to do a search in my Word files to go back and find and fix every single one. I was terrified that I would, that my repeats would not be exactly the same. You know, I was very nerdy about it. So.
Oh, that's right. It's word for word when it does repeat
The dialogue. Yeah, it's not just what happens. It's the way I say it has to be the same, you know.
Now, of course, the book is at heart a murder mystery, answering the title question, who killed one the gun?
Mm.
And there's other murders in there, too. A five and no longer alive.
Yeah.
And a good mystery requires the author to build suspicion, to identify the suspects and their motives, and also build suspense. And I guess keep the reader guessing as well. Did you study other mysteries and some of the masters for guidance? Raymond Chandler might not be the best example because his plots are almost incomprehensible.
They are. They are. I mean, yeah, I've listened to a lot of old time radio stuff, and there's a lot of my research in there. But also, when I was younger, I was a big mystery reader. I was trying to think of names of.
Well, I know Agatha Christie, very famous.
Mm-hmm. Agatha Christie.
For me, the Charlie Chan movies and also Sherlock Holmes movies where, mm-hmm. you know, the great detective, he also has the same challenge of identifying the suspects and narrowing it down till the very end of the movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sherlock Holmes books and Sherlock Holmes radio show, which was a long-standing radio show. Yeah. You know, I read all the Sue Grafton novels. You know, I read a lot of mysteries.
I know there's books because I've talked to mystery writers and there's actually books on how to write a mystery. So there's a whole bunch of guidelines.
There are. I've never read those. So
thank
hopefully
God.
I did a good job. Yeah.
You don't need that with the rampant imagination. You can dispense with the guidelines. Now, in the novel's case, one the gun is trying to solve two mysteries. He's mm-hmm. hired by the insurance agency to find out if five of the no longer alive's death was a suicide or a murder, because the insurance agency would have to pay up.
Correct.
And all the while, he's searching for his own killer. And that's a wonderful twist. That's where the sci-fi elements enter. One, the gun wakes up the next morning after his own murder, finds himself stuck in this time loop, which made me think of the movie Groundhog Day right away.
Yeah.
But how did you come to blend the two genres, so noir and sci-fi? Which, of course, Groundhog Day doesn't have any noir in it.
Totally. I don't know why I decided to blend the two. I had an idea one time. I was thinking about Groundhog Day, actually, and I thought, you know, the one issue that I have with those types of stories is that in the course of the time loops, they go through all the machinations. They try different things, and they progress and they get better. And they, you know, and then at the end of Groundhog Day, he, spoiler alert,
he's
gets
a better
the
man.
Girl. He's a better man, right. And I thought, you know, a time loop is a power. You can do anything you want, and the day will reset the next day. So power is not always a thing that makes us better. And so when I started thinking about doing the time loop.
I think you say in the book, power corrupts pretty much.
Pretty
in
much.
Not so many words.
So that was the reason I started. I wanted to play with the time loop and make something that to me felt more realistic to the way human beings work and just follow what happens when you are given this sort of absolute power. But I decided to do it in a story, which is very unrealistic, obviously. I think that I was so, at the time that I had that idea, I think I was just also at the same time so obsessed with old-time radio and film noir that I just started. And I think I probably said, hey, ooh, remember that old story, Won the Gun? Let's see if I can just shove this in there. You know. So.
And there's a quote in the book that's pretty much the premise, and I just loved it. It seems very unique and wonderful.
Nice.
And that's one says at one point, how can he find out who killed him if no one's killed him yet? So a little harder case than the great detectives have facing them.
Right. Yeah.
And though the book, Gigi, is a blend of noir, murder, mystery, and sci-fi, it's also very funny. Just one example that made me laugh. One, the gun is questioning the doorman at the local dive bar called the Dive Inn. And he's a brute of a fellow, maybe I should say a moose of a fellow, named, of course, For the Door.
Yeah.
Here's the dialogue between one and four. How long have you worked there? One asks. The moose thinks about it. 5 years, maybe eight. And I love that. It's like straight out of a vaudeville routine, like George and Gracie. But the book is not a comedy. How do you balance the humor with the more serious aspects?
That's a good question. I think everything that happened in the course of writing the book was so intuitive for me that I don't think I ever asked myself, how can I make sure that I balance this correctly? I just knew that I wanted it to be a funny book that told some serious stuff. And somehow instinctively I knew when along the course of the arc I needed to start getting, you know, I mean, it wants to be funny at first. It wants to bring people in and be sort of a romp. And then I want to slowly kind of turn the tables and surprise you a bit.
As the characters come
alive. Yeah.
Probably to you in the writing, definitely to the reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I should also mention before I get to the next question, Gigi, we mentioned For the Door. And earlier we mentioned the movie Murder, My Sweet, has a character, Philip Marlowe. It comes to Philip Marlowe and the character, whose name Moose Malloy, wants Marlowe to find his lost girlfriend, Velma, which is pretty much how the movie proceeds from that point. Moose Malloy is, again, kind of a brute of a fellow, like For the Door. He's played by Mike Mazursky, who played that type in a lot of different movies and TV shows.
Yeah.
And you told me you actually modeled For the Door after Moose Malloy.
Yeah, for sure. For the Door, who is he's very tall, he's very big, he's very sort of moosey. I modeled him after Moose Malloy and like a favorite character in one of my favorite old-time radio shows called The Adventures of Frank Race. I put both of them together, and I did call, One the Gun does call For the Door the moose. He does it because it's large, because the character's so big, but it's definitely, that's definitely me putting an Easter egg in there for anybody who watched that movie.
It's a nod to old-time radio fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of those in there, and there's a lot of nods to that movie, and to A Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. I think the most Easter eggs that I have.
One of the best.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to decide what to read for my launch at Powell's, and I was reading a certain section that I thought might be fun, but For the Door's in there, and I kept trying to read him in Mike Mazursky's. I can't think of his.
Mike Mazursky.
Mazursky's.
Yeah, it's like, a tongue twister.
It is a tongue twister. I was trying to like read him out loud like that character, and I can't read this out loud because I can't do that. I can't do that.
No,
that
he's
voice.
kind of a brute like that. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how I think about it in my head.
I want you to find Velma for me.
Exactly.
And Philip Marlowe can't turn him down. Yes. An offer he can't refuse when Moose asks you for something.
Yeah, it's a great movie. So great.
Now, in the spirit of great noir detectives like Philip Marlowe, and the not-so-great like Pat Novak, which is also old-time radio detective, a little less, with a little less gravity and weight than some of the others.
Definitely, yeah.
You sprinkle the story with hard-boiled similes and metaphors. Here's just a few. Just look at her there, smiling that smile that melts you like honey on a hot biscuit. Her perfume wraps around him like the stripes on a candy cane. The scotch is just as he likes it, fresh and medicinal, like the scent of the swab before the needle. So I thought it'd be fun to trade a few of our favorites from old-time radio shows. Mm-hmm. Would you like to lead off?
Sure. I went through my collection and pulled out some favorite things.
Yeah, and I went online.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did Pat Novak, Johnny Dollar, Philip Marlowe.
Yeah, that one's great. That one's great. I have mine come from, and I won't read them all, but I've got Pat Novak. I've got Jeff Regan, which is like very similar to Pat Novak. I've got Pete Kelly's Blues, which is...
Oh, yeah. Same lead as Pat Novak.
Yeah. And then Philip Marlowe.
Jack Webb, Dragnet guy.
Yeah. Jack Webb is so great. He delivers those lines so well. You know.
Yeah, great voice actor.
Yeah, like just that deadpan that he does.
Right.
You know, it's perfect. A lot of actors can deadpan and just seem deadpan, but he somehow puts a little panache in there. I don't know.
The deadest of the pan.
Yeah, totally. The deadest of the pan. Yes. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to pull one out. Her eyes. They were small and so close, you could have saved time and put them in one socket.
Ah, the place was about as cozy as an abandoned mine shaft.
Yes. He sagged forward and poured out of the chair like stiff syrup.
or butter on a hot biscuit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The street was as deserted as a warm bottle of beer.
Nice. Okay, I'm going to do one about about the streets now, about atmosphere. Stroud and I sat opposite each other in silence through that bleak, empty hour when you can almost feel the day that's coming up nudge the one that's just gone by.
It's like poetry.
Right? It is.
My head must have looked like a jackpot. Everyone in town was hitting it.
Love that one. Yes. Speaking of heads, he was tall, wiry, with a thin, arrogant face that sneered out from under an expanse of forehead big enough for three sets of eyebrows.
I should have got out of there right then, but I used my brain like a bottle of medicine, a small dose every 3 hours.
Oh my gosh, that one's amazing. Oh my gosh, that one's amazing. I'm going to give you a Pat Novak woman one here.
Oh, good.
Because they're so great, you know, misogynistic, but you know.
Well, we'll get to that too.
Good writing. She stood there watching me as I walked over to the cashier's window. Oh, she gave you a nice warm feeling like a Bunsen burner in the middle of your back. The way she stood there in the center of the room smiling, you knew she could turn a glacier into a steam bath at 400 yards. A nice little mouse that made you want to go home and test all the old traps.
Oh, man, that's just packed with metaphors and similes.
Amazing.
Wow, that is dense.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got one last one. Again, Pat Novak. So far, it was working out like a crossword cut in half.
So good.
Now, yours truly, Johnny Dollar episode is name-checked in the book, Gigi. Something won the gun heard and found useful for his own work as an insurance investigator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to play the clip, and then, Gigi, I wonder if you'd read the passage in the novel?
Yeah.
Johnny Dollar.
Don Hancock, Johnny, Surety Mutual.
Hi, Don. What's on your mind?
Qui bono.
Qui who?
It's Latin, kiddo. Qui bono. Who benefits?
All right, I'll bite. Who does?
A little doll named Luann Parker down in Green Pass, Virginia. $100,000 worth, Johnny. Double indemnity.
Wow, what did she do? Answer the question?
She sure did, with a .38. Two bullseyes right in her foster papa's heart.
Well, then if it's an open and shut case, you don't
Oh, it's that all right. She's the gal what done it. She admits it. But the coroner is about to call it an unavoidable accident. Seems little old Magnolia Blossom thought Papa was a prowler.
And what do you think?
Just what I said. Qui bono.
So?
I think you'd better put yourself on the payroll.
You were the one who told me about that.
Yeah.
Man, I love that. I actually prefer the multi-episode series to the single ones. They wrap them up way too quick.
Mm-hmm. I do, too. And I went back and listened to the Qui bono matter when you told me that you were going to do that.
Uh-huh.
I just watched it. I listened to it just the other day.
I've listened to it twice now.
Yeah. So much fun, right?
Yes.
I mean, the ending pretty, like, easy, right?
But but the way they get there and
mm-hmm.
just the characters. And
yeah.
It's actually a nice full story as
it
opposed
is.
To let me fill 25 minutes here with
totally.
Commercials.
And, like, the other thing that's interesting because that you get to do when you're listening to these is that you kind of get to watch the artistry of how they put together the radio show. And so every new 15-minute, you know, episode, they have to find a clever way to give you a wrap-up from before. You know, there are things that they're setting up, and so they have to do that in a clever way. So it's always fun to see how they do that. I listened to the Phantom Chase matter yesterday, and that one has 9 parts.
Wow.
The longest one, yeah.
Oh,
great.
I got to look that up.
It's all over the world. It's really cool. It's a fun one. Anyway. Across the club, 8, the first mate, is mixing up a drink in one of those silver shakers. Is what the widow saying the truth? Did 5, the no longer alive, will this place to its former owner? One, the gun knows that in investigation, clues are all well and good, but the most important consideration of all is qui bono, something he heard on a detective radio show once. It means, who benefits?
Right. And that's, of course, an important part of the book.
Yeah.
Now,
and I lied because this takes place... The book takes place generally in the 40s, 50s kind of era. But if you look at like the clues of things like the open air, what I say, it's the 11th day of the 11th month and you know what day of the week it is. I actually realized one day that I know exactly what year this takes place, like if it took place in America at all, in this world at all. And that was 1947. And the qui bono matter of Johnny Dollar is 1956. So it didn't happen before, but he's claiming he's listened to it. Anyway.
Okay, well inexcusable. I should also say that qui bono just thought now we would say follow the money.
Yes.
But it's basically the same thing as totally. Qui bono, just without the Latin.
Yeah, yes.
Now, most of those old-time radio detective shows and detectives and books by writers of the time were narrated by the main character.
Mm-hmm.
Philip Marlowe, I mean, he's a great example in first person. But yeah. You wrote this book in third person and in present tense,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, breaks with writing lessons from your mentor, Tom Spanbauer.
Really yeah.
Why the departure?
Well, when I originally started writing the book in 2002, it was, as I sort of called it, an anthology movie. Obviously, it's not a movie, but it was like, you know, there were four different stories. And so it popped around from different characters. And because of that, I had written that in
right,
third person.
Right, or there'd be too many confusing voices in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, And I was really into like Stephen King's The Stand, and I loved the way that worked, and that was done that way, where you're very over the shoulder, but still in third person with somebody popping around. And then so when I came back to this, it felt natural to go to third person because of that, and it felt natural to go to present tense because he's learning everything as he goes. And so it has the immediacy of this is happening right now.
And time is at a premium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So it does break with the noir vibe in that way. But
Did you get any flack in Dangerous Writers or some of the other writing groups? Why third person? Why not first?
I did get asked about it. I got ribbed about it, I guess, because it was definitely something that Tom Spanbauer would have said, oh, thank you for bringing this in. Now, can you go home and write it in this person? Nah, I don't know whether he would have done that. But Dangerous Writing had sort of finished by then. So I wasn't in the class. But all of my writing, you know, friends know that was sort of outside of at least of what we were learning in that class, you know.
But you put a lot of thought into the reasons why. So.
Yeah.
Now, along with all the suspense and the fun, the book has an underlying theme, I think, courtesy of the time loop. One character laments what one must be going through, the daily repetition of lack and change, the sameness. She says, what good's a conversation if one of you isn't going to remember it tomorrow? What good's a relationship if it can't progress beyond today? And one character also has a grandfather in memory care who can't remember what happens to him. So in effect, he's always reliving the moment as if he's also stuck in a time loop.
Yeah.
So I think the theme is something like we should appreciate change, even be thankful for it rather than resist it.
Mm-hmm.
Almost kind of a seize the day, the present moment.
Yeah.
Be here now.
Yeah. There's very much. Yeah, that's very much a theme that I wanted to explore. There's a way that being in the time loop gets very lonely because your friendships, they can't change. And you can't change anything because everything you do
gets reset the next day.
Gets reset, yeah. And so you lose your purpose. You know, you can't have purpose if you can't make change.
Now, the main female characters in those old-time detective stories are usually one of only two types.
Yeah.
There's either the true blue, like one's assistant to the true blue, or the femme fatales, mm-hmm. like Six, the Kicks.
Yeah.
But I mean, anybody who knows noir, the movies, the radio shows, the stories in print, knows those types.
Yes.
The Madonna and the whore.
Right, totally, yeah.
Of course, you have both types in the book, but that sexism is something you turn on its ear, especially in the ending. I wonder if you could talk about subverting that noir convention without giving too much away. No spoilers. It seems like something you definitely set out to do.
Definitely, yes. It was important to me when I first started thinking about how I wanted to use the time loop and how I wanted to use noir and old-time radio, that I wanted to be able to kind of celebrate those things and also, you know, talk about their shadow sides, the things that are not...
Examine them a little more closely rather than just having the listener or the reader accept them.
Exactly.
These are how dames are.
Exactly, you know, and use that as a way to kind of shine a light on the ways in which those issues like that misogyny are coming back these days as well. Or just, you know, haven't been able to get out from under them, you know.
In addition to a few other things we haven't been able to get out from.
Exactly. Yeah, you know.
Now, do you have plans for an audiobook? I was thinking throughout the whole thing, it'd be great to hear the dialogue spoken in the voice of the 40s noir characters, the detective, the sidekick, the femme fatale, the Moose Malloy, the big dumb muscle guy.
I would love to do an audiobook, yeah. I think, I don't know what the process is for getting one. I think maybe we need to find
I think your publisher's probably been through that, and several other Forest Avenue Press authors have done those.
Yes, they have. I mean, it feels very natural to do one here. And then the question would be, would it get bells and whistles, you know? I mean, I can see, like I had at my Pals launch, I had a Foley artist doing sound effects.
David Ian, that was so good.
The old-fashioned
way with the door closing and...
Yeah, two shoes on his hands to walk down.
Walking across the table. Yeah,
he was fabulous. And so, you know, wouldn't it be fun to do a whole audiobook full of those, you know?
Or a stage production.
With
the mics like they did in old-time radio.
Yeah.
They just read their script in front of the mics and there was a live audience.
Yes, in fact, there was an adaptation of 5 stories of City of Weird
City
that
of
way.
Weird by Willamette Radio Workshop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cindy McGean actually adapted
Mowry.
It for us.
Yeah.
And Sam Mowry, that was a dream for me. For sure.
I love that production.
It was great.
Now, this is your second book published by Forest Avenue Press after City of Weird, which was 2016. And you also design all their covers.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like working with Forest Avenue and their publisher, Laura Stanfill? And what was Laura's role on this book?
What it was like was a dream come true. She was my dream publisher when I was finishing the book up and thinking about having to make a plan for how I wanted to try to sell it. You know, what they kind of tell you to do is start with agents and then, you know, see if you can get a one of the big publishers and sort of work your way down to small press. And I always, in the back of my mind, basically wanted this to be a Forest Avenue Press book. It is a Forest Avenue Press book. It is in the spirit of that, of the press, you know. And so I didn't even write that list down. I just submitted just to them because I knew how good she is to her, to everybody she works with.
Yeah, and the quality of the books.
Mm-hmm.
She only publishes about 2 a year on average. We should also mention, Gigi, that Laura came out with her own book, a writing guide called Imagine a Door.
Mm-hmm.
That was earlier in the year.
Yeah.
And that first guideline that you mentioned, you know, find an agent and sell it to a big 5 publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're big 4 by now.
I think they might be.
Yeah, it's not the only route.
Exactly.
And may not be the best one even.
Exactly. Yeah. It's been working with Laura and Forest Avenue Press has been seriously... It was the best decision I could have possibly made for my book.
Now, we should mention someone who's gone now, but was an important mentor and friend to you, Robert
mm-hmm.
Hill.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk about Robert?
So Robert was in the Henry Writing Group. So he was part of the group that I was bringing my book to. And he was also one of the reasons I most thought of my book as a Forest Avenue Press book, because his book, The Remnants, which came out through Forest Avenue, they feel like cousins to me. It's rampant imagination, you know. It's wordplay. It's
which kind of freed you up, didn't it? Gave you carte blanche to do that for yourself.
It really did. It really did. And to feel like maybe I can write something that is really fun, that surprises you with where it can go, which is what happens with The Remnants. Yeah. Robert was... He would have been the first person to read the book in full, meaning not 7 pages a week when we would, you know, bring
right.
him into group. I gave him my book. He gave me the one he was working on, and I read his, and he was reading mine. And then that's when he died.
Mm.
So yeah, I miss him a lot.
Now, one last question, Gigi. You always have a lot of projects going on at once. So,
yes.
Cover designer,
yeah.
Writer, marketing at Powell's, and probably a score of other stuff. What are you working on now? A book, a cover, probably a lot simultaneously, huh?
Yeah, I'm working on a lot of different design projects. I haven't started back into writing things again yet because, you know, I'm busy sort of promoting the book and working on projects. A favorite project that I'm working on is to bring together excerpts and poetry that Steve Arndt, who we were speaking about before, has written through the years, and putting together a book for him because he's an amazing poet and novelist, and I'm just such a fan. And I just told him one day, I think we should make you a book. Oh no, yeah, I think we should make you a book, and so we're going to do that.
Oh, I can't wait to read that. Yeah, yeah. I love Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Gigi, thanks so much for talking with us today. In the words of Philip Marlowe, to say goodbye is to die a little.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Gigi Little, author of the debut novel Who Killed Won the Gun from Forest Avenue Press. You can learn more about Gigi, her work, both as author, editor, and book designer, online at ggilittle.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, November 13th. This is Ten, the host named Ken, no relation, saying,
tomorrow, the net tightens, a rat runs for cover, then the whole thing blows wide open. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Shawnee Dollar.